As wealth and literacy spread, a wide renaissance began. As I watched, the birth visions of many of the participants came into my view. They knew that human destiny was to develop an empowered democracy, and they came hoping to bring it into being. The writings of the Greeks and Romans were discovered and stimulated their memories. The first democratic parliaments were established, and calls were issued for an end to the divine right of kings and the bloody reign of the churchmen over spiritual and social reality. Soon came the Protestant Reformation, which held the promise that individuals could go directly to important scriptures and to conceive a direct connection to the divine. At the same time, individuals seeking greater empowerment and freedom were exploring the American continent, a landmass symbolically lying between the cultures of the East and West. As I watched the birth visions of the Europeans most inspired to enter this new world, I could see that they came knowing that this land was already inhabited, aware that communication and immigration should be undertaken only by invitation. Deep inside, they knew that the Americas were to be the grounding, the road back, for a Europe quickly losing its sense of sacred intimacy with the natural environment and moving toward a dangerous secularism. The Native American cultures, while not perfect, provided a model from which the European mentality could regain its roots. Yet again, because of the fear, these individuals were able to intuit only the drive to move to this land, sensing a new freedom and liberty of spirit, but bringing with them the need to dominate and conquer and pursue their own security. The important truths of the native cultures were lost in the rush to exploit the region's vast natural resources. Meanwhile, in Europe, the Renaissance continued, and I began to see the full scope of the second insight. The power of the church to define reality was diminishing, and Europeans were feeling as though they were awakening to look at life anew. Through the courage of countless individuals, all inspired by their intuitive memories, the scientific method was embraced as a democratic process of exploring and coming to understand the world in which humans found themselves. Those in the church, entrenched in fear, sought to squelch this new science. As political forces lined up on both sides, finally a compromise was reached. Science would be free to explore the outer material world, but must leave spiritual phenomena to the dictates of the still influential churchmen. Despite these restrictions, science began to map out and describe the operation of the physical world, providing information rich in ways to increase trade and utilize natural resources. Human economic security increased, and slowly we began to lose our sense of mystery and our heartfelt questions about the purpose of life. We decided it was purposeful enough just to survive and build a better, more secure world for ourselves and our children. In this growing materialism, God could only be viewed as a distant deist God, a God who merely pushed the universe into being and then stood back to let it run in a mechanical sense, like a predictable machine. Yet, here, I could see the birth intent of many of the individuals of this time period. They came knowing the development of technology and production were important because it could eventually be made non-polluting and sustainable and could liberate humankind beyond all imagination. But in the beginning, born into the milieu of the time, all they could remember was the general intuition to build and produce and work, holding tightly to the democratic ideal. The vision shifted. And I could see that nowhere was this intuition stronger than in the creation of the United States, with its democratic constitution and its system of checks and balances. As a grand experiment, America was set up for the rapid exchange of ideas that was to characterize the future. Yet, below the surface, the messages of the Native Americans and the Native Africans and other peoples on whose backs the American experiment was initiated all cried out to be heard, to be integrated into the European mentality. By the 19th century, we were on the verge of a second great transformation of human culture, a transformation that would be built on the new energy sources of oil and steam, and finally electricity. The human economy had developed into a vast and complicated field of endeavor, which supplied more products than ever before through an explosion of new techniques. In great numbers, people were moving from rural communities to great urban centers of production, shifting from life on the farm to involvement in the new, specialized industrial revolution. At the time, most believed that democratically founded capitalism, unfettered by government regulation, seemed to be the desired method of human commerce. Yet again, as I picked up on individual birth visions, I could see that most individuals born into this period had come hoping to evolve capitalism toward a more perfect form. Unfortunately, the level of fear was such that all they managed to intuit was a desire to build individual security, to exploit other workers, and to maximize profits at every turn, often entering into collusive agreements with competitors and with governments. This was the great era of the robber barons and of secret banking and industrial cartels. However, by the early 20th century, because of the abuses of this freewheeling capitalism, two other economic systems were set to be offered as alternatives. Earlier, in England, two men had posed an alternative manifesto, which called for a new system run by workers, which would eventually create an economic utopia, where the resources of the whole of humanity would be made available to each person according to his needs, without greed or competition. In the horrible working conditions of the day, the idea attracted many supporters. But I quickly saw that this materialistic workers' manifesto had been a corruption of the original intention. When the birth visions of the two men came into view, I realized that what they were intuiting was that human destiny was to eventually achieve such a utopia. Unfortunately, they failed to remember that this utopia could only be accomplished through democratic participation, born of free will and slowly evolved. Consequently, the initiators of this communist system, from the first revolution in Russia to all the eventual satellite countries, erroneously thought that this system could be created through force and dictatorship, an approach which failed miserably and cost millions of lives. In their impatience, the individuals involved had envisioned a utopia that had created communism and decades of tragedy. The scene shifted to the other alternative to a democratic capitalism, the evil of fascism. This system was designed to enhance the profits and control of a ruling elite, who thought of themselves as privileged leaders of human society. I saw clearly that in creating such a system, the participants were almost totally unconscious of their birth visions. They had come here wishing only to promote the idea that civilization was evolving toward perfectibility, and that a nation of people, totally unified in purpose and will, striving to attain their fullest potential, could reach great heights of energy and effectiveness. What was created was a fearful, self-serving vision wrongly claiming the superiority of certain races and nations, and the possibility of developing a supernation whose destiny was to rule the world. Again, the intuition that all humans were evolving toward perfection was distorted by weak, fearful men into the murderous reign of the Third Reich. I watched as others, who had likewise envisioned the perfectibility of mankind, but who were in greater touch with the importance of an empowered democracy, intuited that they must stand up against both alternatives to a freely expressed economy. The first stand resulted in a bloody world war against the fascist distortion, finally won at extreme cost. The second resulted in a long and bitter Cold War against the communist bloc. I suddenly found myself focusing on the United States during the early years of this Cold War, the decade of the 50s. At this time, America stood successfully at the apex of what had been a 400-year preoccupation with secular materialism. Affluence and security had spread to include a large and growing middle class, and into this material success was born an enormous new generation, a generation whose intuitions would lead humanity toward a third great transformation. This generation grew up constantly reminded that they lived in the greatest country in the world, the land of the free, with liberty and justice for all its citizens. Yet, as they matured, members of this generation found a disturbing disparity between this popular American self-image and actual reality. They found that many people in this land, certain racial minorities and women, were, by law and custom, definitely not free. By the 60s, the new generation was inspecting closely, and many were finding, other disturbing aspects of the United States self-image. For instance, a blind patriotism that expected young people to go into a foreign land to fight a political war that had no clearly expressed purpose and no prospect of victory. Just as disturbing was the culture's spiritual practice. The materialism of the previous 400 years had pushed the mystery of life and death far into the background. Many found the churches and synagogues full of pompous and meaningless ritual. The attendance seemed more social than spiritual, and the members too restricted by a sense of how they might be perceived and judged by their onlooking peers. As the vision progressed, I could tell that the new generation's tendency to analyze and judge arose from a deep-seated intuition that there was more to life than the old material reality took into account. The new generation sensed a new spiritual meaning just beyond the horizon, and they began to explore other, less-known religions and spiritual points of view. For the first time, the Eastern religions were understood in great numbers, serving to validate the mass intuition that spiritual perception was an inner experience, a shift in awareness that changed forever one's sense of identity and purpose. Similarly, the Jewish Kabbalist writings and the Western Christian mystics, such as Meister Eckhart and Teilhard de Chardin, provided other intriguing descriptions of a deeper spirituality. At the same time, new information was surfacing from the human sciences, sociology, psychiatry, psychology, and anthropology, as well as from modern physics, casting new light on the nature of human consciousness and creativity. This culmination of thought, together with the perspective provided by the East, gradually began to crystallize into what was later called the human potential movement, the emerging belief that human beings were presently actualizing only a small portion of their vast physical, psychological, and spiritual potential. I watched as, over the course of several decades, this information and the spiritual experience it spawned grew into a critical mass of awareness, a leap in consciousness from which we began to formulate a new view of what living a human life was all about, including, ultimately, an actual remembrance of the 9 insights. Yet, even as this new view was crystallizing, surging through the human world as a contagion of consciousness, many others in the new generation began to pull back, suddenly alarmed at the growing instability in culture, which seemed to correspond to the arrival of the new paradigm. For hundreds of years, the solid agreements of the old world view had maintained a well-defined, even rigid order to human life. Then came the 60s wave of questioning and analysis and criticism, and the unwavering rules suddenly began to crumble. In this climate, what others thought ceased to be the real detriment of our actions and conduct. Increasingly, our behavior was being determined by our own inner ethics. For those who had truly adopted a more lived, spiritual point of view, characterized by honesty and love toward others, ethical behavior was not a problem. But of concern were those who had lost the outer guidelines for living, without yet forming a strong inner code. They seemed to be falling into a cultural no-man's land, where now anything seemed to be permissible. Crime and drugs and addictive impulses of all kinds, not to mention a loss of the work ethic. To make matters worse, many seem to be using the new findings of the human potential movement to imply that criminals and deviants weren't really even responsible for their own actions. Instead, they were viewed as victims of an oppressive culture that shamelessly allowed the social conditions which shaped this behavior to endure. As I continued to watch, I suddenly understood what I was seeing. A polarization of viewpoint was quickly forming around the planet, as those who were undecided now reacted against a cultural viewpoint they saw leading to runaway chaos and uncertainty, perhaps even to the total disintegration of their way of life. In the United States especially, a growing group of people were becoming convinced they were now facing what amounted to a life and death struggle against the permissiveness and liberalism of the past 25 years. a culture war, as they called it, with nothing short of the survival of Western civilization at stake. I could see that many of them even considered the cause already near lost, and thus advocated extreme action. In the face of this backlash, I could see the advocates of human potential moving into fear and defensiveness themselves, sensing that many hard-earned victories for individual rights and social compassion were now in danger of being swept away by a tide of conservatism. Many considered this reaction against liberation an attack by the embattled forces of greed and exploitation, who were pushing forth in one last attempt to dominate the weaker members of society. Here I could clearly see what was intensifying the polarization. Each side was thinking the other to be a conspiracy of evil. The advocates of the old worldview were no longer considering the human potentialists as misguided or naive, but were in fact considering them to be part of a larger conspiracy of big government socialists, holdout adherents of the communist solution, who were seeking to accomplish exactly what was occurring: the erosion of cultural life to the point where an all-powerful government could come in and straighten everything out. For the advocates of liberation and change, just the opposite scenario seemed more likely. In the face of the conservatives' political gains, all that they had worked for seemed to be crashing before their eyes. They, too, observed the increasing violent crime and the degenerating family structures. Only for them, the cause was not too much government intervention, but too little, too late. My awareness suddenly jumped to a higher level, and I finally understood the polarization completely. Great numbers of people seemed to be gravitating to one perspective or the other, with both sides raising the stakes to that of war, of good versus evil, and both visualizing the other as the perpetrators of a grand conspiracy. And in the background, I now understood the growing influence of those people who claimed to be able to explain this emergent evil. These were the end times analysts to whom Joel had referred earlier. In the growing turmoil of the transition, these interpreters were beginning to increase their power. In their view, the Bible's prophecies were to be understood literally, and what they saw in the uncertainty of our times was the long-awaited apocalypse. Soon would come the outright holy war in which humans would be divided between the forces of darkness and armies of light. They envisioned this war as a real physical conflict, fast and bloody, and for those who knew it was coming, only one decision was important: to be on the correct side when the fighting began. Yet, simultaneously, just as with the other landmark turns in human history, I could see beyond the fear and entrenchment to the actual birth visions of those involved. Clearly, everyone on both sides of the polarization had come into the physical dimension intending that this polarization not be so intense. We wanted a smooth transition from the old materialistic worldview to the new spiritual one. And we wanted a transformation in which the best of the older traditions would be recognized and integrated into the new world that was emerging. I could clearly see that this growing belligerence was an aberration, coming not from intention, but from the fear. Our original vision was that the ethics of human society would be maintained, and at the same time, each person could be fully liberated and the environment protected, and that economic creativity would be conserved and transformed at the same time, all by introducing an overriding spiritual purpose. And further, that this spiritual awareness could descend into the world and initiate a utopia in a way that symbolically fulfilled the end times scriptures. Suddenly, my awareness amplified even further. And just as when I had watched Maya's birth vision, I could almost glimpse this higher spiritual understanding, the full picture of where human history was intended to go from here, how we could achieve this reconciliation of views, and go on to fulfill our human destiny. Then, as before, my head began to spin, and I lost concentration. I couldn't reach the level of energy needed to grasp it. The vision began to disappear, and I strained to hold on, seeing the current situation one last time. Clearly, without the mediating influence of the world vision, the polarization of fear would continue to accelerate. I could see the two sides hardening, their feelings intensifying as both began to think the other not to be just wrong, but hideous, venal, in league with the devil himself. After a moment of dizziness and a sense of rapid movement, I looked around and saw Will beside me. He glanced my way, then gazed out at the dark gray environment, a concerned expression on his face. We had traveled to a new location. "Were you able to see my vision of history?" I asked. He nodded. "What we just saw was a new spiritual interpretation of history, somewhat specific to your cultural view, but amazingly revealing. I've never seen anything like that before. This has to be part of the tenth, a clear view of the human quest as seen in the afterlife. We are understanding that everyone is born with a positive intention, trying to bring more of the knowledge contained in the afterlife into the physical. All of us. History has been a long process of awakening. When we are born into the physical, of course, we run into this problem of going unconscious and having to be socialized and trained in the cultural reality of the day. After that, all we can remember are these gut feelings, these intuitions to do certain things. But we constantly have to fight the fear. Often the fear is so great we fail to follow through with what we intended, or we distort it somehow. But everyone, and I mean everyone, comes in with the best of intentions."
"I don't know," I said. "Aren't some people just inherently bad?"
"No, they just go crazy in the fear and make horrible mistakes. But what has to be understood is that these horrible acts are caused in part by our very tendency to assume that some people are naturally evil. That's the mistaken view that fuels the polarization. Each side thinks the other is involved in a conspiracy of the greatest sort," he added, "the embodiment of all that's negative." I noticed he was looking out toward the distance again, and when I followed his eyes, and also focused on the environment, I began to pick up an ominous sense of darkness and foreboding. "I think," he continued, "that we can't bring in the world vision or resolve the polarization until we understand the real nature of evil and the actual reality of hell."
"Why do you say that?" I asked.
He glanced at me one more time, then gazed out again into the dull gray. "Because hell is exactly where we are." A chill surged through my body as I looked out on the gray environment. The ominous feeling I perceived earlier was turning into a clear sense of alienation and despair.
"Have you been here before?" I asked Will.
"Only to the edge," he replied. "Never out here in the middle.
Do you feel how cold it is?"
I nodded as my eye caught sight of movement.
"What is that?"
Will shook his head.
"I'm not sure."
A swirling mass of energy seemed to be moving in our direction.
"It must be another soul group," I said.
As they came closer, I tried to focus on their thoughts, feeling an even greater sense of alienation, even anger. I tried to shrug it off, open up more.
"Wait," I vaguely heard Will say. "You're not strong enough."
But it was too late. I was suddenly pulled into an intense blackness, and then beyond it, into a large town of some kind. In terror, I looked around, struggling to keep my wits, and realized that the architecture indicated a 19th century time period. I was standing on a street corner full of people walking by, and in the distance was the raised dome of a Capitol building. At first, I thought I was actually in that time period, but several aspects of the reality were wrong. The horizon faded out into a strange gray color, and the sky was olive green, similar to the sky above the office construction that Williams had created when he was avoiding the realization that he had died. I suddenly became aware of four men watching me from the opposite street corner. An icy cold feeling swept my body. All were well dressed, and one cocked his head and took a puff from a large cigar. Another checked a watch and returned it to his vest pocket. Their look was sophisticated, but menacing.
"Anyone who has raised their ire is a friend of mine," a low voice spoke from behind me.
I turned to see a large, barrel-shaped man, also well-dressed. and wearing a wide-brimmed felt hat, walking toward me. His face seemed familiar. He had been the commander of the federal troops I had seen in the visions of the 18th century war, the one who had refused to see Maya and had ordered the battle against the native people to begin. All this was a construction, I thought. He must have recreated his later life situation in order to avoid realizing he was dead.
"This is not real," I blurted. "You're, deceased."
He seemed to completely ignore my statement.
"So, what have you done to piss off that bunch of jackals?"
"I haven't done anything."
"Oh, yes, you've done something. I know that look they're giving you. They think they run this town, you know. In fact, they think they can run the whole world."
"Listen," I said, "try to understand, none of this is real."
"Hey," he replied, "I would suggest that you take me into your confidence. If they're against you, I'm the only friend you have." I looked away, but I could tell he was still eyeing me suspiciously. "They're treacherous people," he went on. "They'll never forgive you. Take my situation, for example. All they wanted was to use my military experience to squash the Indians and open up their lands. But I was on to them. I knew they couldn't be trusted, but I would have to look out for myself." He gave me a wry look. "It's harder for them to use you and throw you away if you're a war hero, right? After the war, I sold myself to the public. That way these characters had to play ball with me. But let me tell you, never underestimate these people. They're capable of anything."
He backed away from me a moment, as if pondering my appearance.
"In fact," he added, "they may have sent you as a spy."
I saw him reach into a pocket and pull out a short knife. Petrified, I forced my body to move, running down the street and ducking into alleyways until I lost sight of him. The streets were now completely empty, except for one carriage. It pulled up to the hotel across from me, and a beautiful woman, dressed in evening attire, got out and glanced over toward me, then smiled. There was something warm and caring about her demeanor. I dashed across the street toward her, and she paused to watch me approach, her smile coy and inviting.
"You're alone," she said.
"Why don't you join me?"
"Where are you going?" I asked tentatively.
"To a party." She opened the door to the building and motioned for me to come with her. We walked into the elevator, and she pushed the button for the fourth floor. As we rode up, the sensation of warmth and caring increased with each floor. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw her staring at my hands. When I looked, she smiled again and pretended to have been caught. The elevator opened, and she led me down the hall to a particular door and knocked twice. After a moment, the door was unlocked, and a man looked out. His face lit up at the sight of the woman.
"Come in," he said. "Come in."
She invited me to enter ahead of her, and as I walked in, a young woman reached over and took my arm. She was dressed in a strapless gown and was barefoot.
"Oh, you're lost," she said. "Poor thing. You'll be safe in here with us."
Past the door, I could see a man without a shirt.
"Look at those thighs," he commented, staring at me.
"He has perfect hands," another said.
In a state of shock, I realized the room was crowded with people, all in various stages of nudity and lovemaking.
"No, wait," I said. I can't stay."
The woman on my arm said,
"You would go back out there? It takes forever to find a group like this. Feel the energy in here. Not like the fear of being alone, huh?"
She moved her hand across my chest. Suddenly, there was the sound of a scuffle on the other side of the room.
"No, leave me alone," someone shouted. "I don't want to be here."
A young man, no older than 18, pushed several people away and ran through the door. I used the distraction to run out behind him. Not waiting for the elevator, he bounded down the adjacent stairs and I followed. When I reached the street, he was already on the other side. I was about to shout for him to stop when I saw him freeze in terror. Ahead on the sidewalk was the commander, still holding the knife, but this time facing the other group of men who had watched me earlier. They were all talking at the same time, posturing angrily. Abruptly, one of the group pulled a gun, and the commander rushed toward him with a knife. Shots rang out, and the commander's hat and knife flew backward, as the bullet pierced his forehead. He dropped to the ground with a thud, and as he did, the other man stopped in mid-motion and began to fade away until they disappeared completely. Just as quickly, the man on the ground also disappeared. Across from me, the young man sat wearily down on the curb and put his head in his hands. "It's okay," I said. "They're gone."
"No, they're not,"
he said in frustration. "Look over there." I turned and saw the four men who had disappeared standing across the street in front of the hotel. Unbelievably, they were in the exact position they had been in when I had first seen them. One puffed his cigar, and the other checked his watch.
"This keeps happening over and over," the young man said. "I can't stand this anymore. Someone's got to help me."
Before I could say anything, two forms materialized to his right, but remained obscured, out of focus. The young man stared at the forms for a long time, then, with a look of excitement on his face, said,
"Roy, is that you?"
As I watched, the two forms moved toward him until he was completely hidden by their weaving shapes. After several minutes, he had completely disappeared, along with the two souls. I stared at the empty curb where he had been sitting, feeling remnants of a higher vibration. Suddenly, in my mind's eye, I saw my soul group again, and felt their deep caring and love. Concentrating on the feeling, I was able to shake off the blanketing anxiety and to amplify my energy in increments until I finally began to open up inside. Immediately, the environment shifted to lighter shades of gray, and the town disappeared. As my energy increased, I was able to imagine Will's face, and instantly, he was beside me. "Are you okay?" he asked, turning to embrace me. His expression showed immense relief. "Those illusions were strong. You willed yourself right into them." "I know. I couldn't think. Couldn't remember what to do. You were gone a long time. All we could do was send you energy." "Well, who do you mean by we?"
"All these souls?"
Will's hand gestured outwardly. When I looked fully, I could see hundreds of beings stretching as far as I could see in an enormous circle. Some were looking directly at us, but all of the others appeared to be focused in another direction. I looked to see where they were staring, following their gaze finally to several large swirls of energy far in the distance. When I concentrated my focus, I realized that one of the swirls was, in fact, the town from which I had just escaped. "What are those places?" I asked Will. "Mental constructions," he replied, "set up by souls who, in life, lived very restrictive control dramas and could not wake up after death. Many thousands of them exist out there." "Were you able to see what was happening when I was in the construction?" "Most of it. When I focused on the souls nearby, I could pick up their view of what was happening to you. This ring of souls is constantly beaming energy into the illusions, hoping someone will respond."
"Did you see the young kid?
He was able to wake up, but the others didn't seem to pay attention to anything." Will turned to face me. "Do you remember what we saw during William's life review? At first, he couldn't accept what was happening, and he began to repress his death to the extent that he created a mental construction of his office."
"Yes, I thought of that when I was down there."
"Well, that's how it works for everyone. If we die, and we've been so immersed in our control drama and routine as a way to repress the mystery and insecurity of life to such a degree that we can't even wake up after death, then we create these illusions or trances so that we can continue the same way of feeling safe, even after we enter the afterlife. If William's soul group had not reached him, he would have entered one of those hellish places where you were. It's all a reaction to fear. The people there would be paralyzed with fear if they didn't find some way to ward it off, to repress it below consciousness. What they're doing is repeating the same dramas, the same coping devices they practiced in life, and they can't stop."
"So these illusionary realities are just severe control dramas?"
"Yes. They all fall within the general styles of the control dramas, except that they are more intense and non-reflective. For example, the guy with the knife, the commander, was no doubt an intimidator in the way he stole energy from others. He rationalized his behavior by assuming that the world was out to get him. And, of course, in his life on Earth, These expectations drew just those kinds of people into his life. So his mental vision was fulfilled. Here he just created imaginary people to be after him so he could reproduce the exact situation. I thought of the commander again. Something really strange happened down there. The man who was chasing me was killed, and then he seemed to come back to life and start the drama all over again. That's how it works in this self-imposed hell. All these illusions always play out and blow up in the end. And it works the same way in the physical dimension. A compulsive control drama always fails sooner or later. Usually it happens during the trials and challenges of life. Routines break down, and the anxiety rushes in. It is what's called hitting bottom. This is the time to wake up and handle the fear in another way. But if a person can't, then he or she goes right back into the trance. And if one doesn't wake up in the physical dimension, one might have difficulty waking up in the other as well. These compulsive trances account for all horrible behavior in the physical dimension. This is the psychology of all truly evil acts, the motivation behind the inconceivable behavior of child molesters, sadists, and serial monsters of all kinds. They're simply repeating the only behavior they know that will numb the mind and keep away the anxiety that comes from the lostness they feel. So, you're saying, I interjected, that there is no organized conspiratorial evil in the world, no satanic plot to which we fall prey? None. There is only human fear and the bizarre ways that humans try to ward it off. Well, what about the many references in sacred texts and scriptures to Satan? This idea is a metaphor, a symbolic way of warning people to look to the divine for security, not to their sometimes tragic ego urges and habits. Blaming an outside force for everything bad was perhaps important at a certain stage in human development. But now, it obscures the truth, because blaming our behavior on forces outside ourselves is a way of avoiding responsibility. And we tend to use the idea of Satan to project that some people are inherently evil, so we can dehumanize the ones we disagree with and write them off. It is time now to understand the true nature of human evil in a more sophisticated way, and then to deal with it. Well, if there is no satanic plot, I said, then possession doesn't exist. No, Will said emphatically, psychological possession does exist. It is not the result of a conspiracy of evil. It is just energy dynamics. Fearful people want to control others. That's why certain groups try to pull you in and convince you to follow them and ask you to submit to their authority or fight you if you try to leave. Will paused as if in thought, then continued. All this is more of the tenth insight. That's why we're seeing it. As communication between the two dimensions increases, we'll begin to have more encounters with souls in the afterlife. This part of the insight is that we must discern between those souls who are awake and connected with the spirit of love and those who are fearful and stuck in an obsessive trance of some kind. But we must do so without invalidating and dehumanizing those caught in such fear dramas by thinking that they are demons or devils. They are souls in a growth process, just like us. In fact, in the earth dimension, those who are now caught up in dramas from which they can't escape are often the very souls who were the most optimistic in their birth visions. I shook my head, not following his meaning. That is why, he continued, they chose to be born into such drastic, fearful situations that necessitate such intense, crazy coping devices. You're talking about coming into abusive and dysfunctional families and that sort of situation? Yes. Intense control dramas of all kinds, whether they are violent or just perverse and strange addictions, all come from environments where life is so abusive and dysfunctional and constricted, and the level of fear is so great that they spawn the same rage and anger or perversion over and over, generation after generation. The individuals who are born into these situations choose to do so on purpose, with clarity. The idea seemed preposterous to me. Why would anyone want to be born into a place like that? Because they were sure they had enough strength to break out, to end the cycle, to heal the family system in which they would be born. They were confident that they could awaken and work through the resentment and anger at finding themselves in these deprived circumstances, and see it all as a preparation for a mission, usually one of helping others out of similar situations. Even if they are violent, we have to see them as having the potential to break free of the drama. Well, then the liberal perspective on crime and violence, the idea that everyone can change and be rehabilitated, is the desirable one. The conservative approach is without merit. Will smiled. Not exactly. The liberals are right to see that people who have grown up in abusive and oppressive situations are a product of their environments. And the conservatives are out of touch to the extent that they believe stopping a life of crime or a public dole is just a matter of making a conscious choice. But the liberal approach is superficial as well, to the degree they believe people can change if offered different circumstances, better financial support or education, for instance. Usually, intervention programs focus only on helping others to better their decision-making and economic choices. In the case of violent offenders, rehabilitation attempts have always offered, at best, superficial counseling, and in the worst cases, excuses and leniency, which is precisely the wrong thing to do. Every time someone with a disturbed control drama is slapped on the hand, turned loose with no consequences, it enables the behavior to continue and reinforces the idea that this behavior is not serious, which just sets up the circumstances that guarantee it will occur again. What can be done? I asked. Will seemed to be vibrating with excitement. We can learn to intervene spiritually. And that means helping to bring the whole process into consciousness, as these souls here are doing for those caught in the illusions. Will was staring at the souls in the ring, then looked at me and shook his head. I can get all the information I just relayed to you from these souls, but I still can't see the world vision clearly. We haven't learned how to build enough energy yet. I focused on the souls in the ring, but could get no information other than what Will had conveyed. Clearly the soul groups held a greater knowledge, and were projecting this knowledge toward the fear constructions. But like Will, I still couldn't quite understand anything more. At least we have another piece of the tenth insight, Will said. We know that no matter how undesirable the behavior of others is, we have to grasp that they are just souls attempting to wake up, like us. Suddenly, I was jolted backwards by a blast of dissonant noise, images of whirling colors seizing my mind. Will lunged forward and caught me at the last moment, pulling me into his energy, and again, holding my back firmly. For a moment, I seemed to shake violently. And then, the discord passed. They've started the experiment again, Will said. I shook off the dizziness and looked at him. That means Curtis will probably try to use force to stop them. He's convinced that's the only way. As soon as I spoke those words, I saw a clear picture of Feynman in my mind. He was somewhere overlooking the valley. Glancing at Will, I realized that he had seen the same image. He nodded in agreement, and we instantly began to move. When we stopped moving, Will and I were facing each other. Around us was more gray. Another loud, disharmonious sound shattered the silence, and Will's face began to lose focus. He continued to hold on to me, and after several moments, the sound ended. These sound bursts are coming more frequently now, Will said. We may not have much time left. I nodded, fighting the dizziness. Let's look around, Will said. As soon as we focused on our surroundings, we saw what appeared to be a mass of energy several hundred yards away. Immediately, it closed to within 40 or 50 feet. Be careful, Will cautioned. Don't identify completely with them. Just listen and find out who they are. I focused warily and immediately saw souls in motion and an image of the town from which I had escaped. I recoiled in fear, which actually made them come closer to us. Stay centered in love, Will instructed. They can't pull us in unless we act as though we want them to save us. Try to send them love and energy. It will either help them or make them run away. Realizing the souls were more afraid than I was, I found my center and beamed them love energy. Immediately, they moved rapidly away from us to their original position. Why can't they accept the love and wake up? I asked Will. Because when they feel the energy and it raises their consciousness a degree, their preoccupation lifts somewhat and doesn't fend off the anxiety of their aloneness. Coming into awareness and breaking free of a control drama always feels anxious at first, because the compulsion has to lift before the inward solution to the lostness can be found. That's why a dark night of the soul sometimes precedes increased awareness and spiritual euphoria. A movement to the right caught our attention. When I focused, I realized that other souls were in the area. They came closer, and the others moved away. I strained to pick up what the group was doing. "Why do you think this group is here?" I asked Will. Will shrugged. "They have something to do with this guy, Feynman." Gradually, in the space around the group, I began to see a moving image, a scene of some kind. When I brought it clearly into focus, I realized it was the image of an expansive industrial plant somewhere on Earth, with large metal buildings and rows of what looked like transformers and pipe and miles of interlinking wire. At the center of the complex, atop one of the largest buildings, was a command center of pure glass. Inside, I could see rows of computers and gauges of all descriptions. I glanced at Will. Movement at one end of the complex attracted our attention. Emergency vans and fire trucks were arriving at one of the larger buildings. An ominous glow radiated from the third floor windows. At one point, the glow brightened, and then the ground under the entire building seemed to crack. In an explosion of dust and debris, the building shuddered and then slowly collapsed. To the right, another building suddenly burst into flames. The scene moved to the command center, where, inside, technicians moved frantically. Then, from the right, a door opened, and a man entered with an armful of charts and blueprints. He laid them out on a main table, and worked with what appeared to be a determined confidence. Walking to one side of the room, he began to adjust switches and dials. Gradually, the ground stopped shaking, and the fires were brought under control. He continued to work hastily and to instruct the other technicians. I looked at the individual, now in charge, more closely, and then turned to Will. "That's Feynman." Before Will could respond, the scene shifted into fast forward. Before our eyes, the plant was saved. Then quickly, workers began to dismantle it, building by building. At the same time, on a site nearby, a new, smaller facility was being constructed that would manufacture more compact generators. Finally, most of the complex had been returned to its natural, wooded state. And the new facility was turning out small units that we could see behind each house and business throughout the countryside. Abruptly, our perspective backed away until we could see a single individual in the foreground watching the same scene as we were. When we could see his profile, I realized that it was Feynman, before his current birth, contemplating what he could achieve in life. Will and I looked at each other. "This is part of his birth vision, isn't it?" I asked. Will nodded. "This must be his soul group. Let's see how much more we can find out about him." We both focused on the group, and instantly another image formed in front of us. It was the 19th century war camp, the headquarters tent again. We could see Feynman together with his field commander, the man I had seen earlier in the illusional town. As we watched their interaction, we began to pick up on the story of their association. A bright tactician, Feynman was in charge of strategy and technological developments. In advance of the attack, the commander had ordered smallpox-laden blankets, covertly traded to the Native Americans, a tactic Feynman adamantly opposed, not so much because of its effect on the indigenous people, as because he felt that it was politically indefensible. Afterward, even as the success of the battle was being hailed in Washington, the press found out about the use of smallpox, and an investigation was launched. The commander and his cronies in Washington set Feynman up as the scapegoat, and his career was ruined. Later, the commander set forth on a glorious political career of national stature, before he was also treacherously double-crossed by the same Washington insiders. Feynman, for his part, never recovered. His own political ambitions had been totally destroyed. He attempted to assassinate the ex-politician at a state dinner and was shot dead by bodyguards. Because Feynman had cut himself off from his inner security and love, he could not fully awaken after death. For years, he believed he had escaped his ill-fated attempt to kill his old commander, and had lived in illusionary constructions, holding on to his hate, and doomed to the repeated horror of planning and attempting another assassination, only to be shot, over and over. As I watched, I realized that Feynman could have been trapped in the illusions for a much longer period of time, except for the determined efforts of another man who had been at the military encampment with Feynman. I could see an image of his face, and I recognized his expression. "That's Joel again, the journalist I met," I said to Will without losing my focus on the image. Will nodded in response. After death, Joel had become a member of the Outer Soul Ring and became totally dedicated to waking up Feynman. His intention during the lifetime of Feynman had been to expose any cruelty or treachery on the part of the military toward the Native Americans. But even though he had known about the smallpox contamination, he had been persuaded to keep quiet by a combination of bribes and threats. After death, he had been devastated by his life review, but had remained conscious and had vowed to help Feynman, who he felt had been ruined because of his failure to intervene. After a long period of time, Feynman finally responded and underwent a long and painful life review himself. He had originally intended in the 19th century life to become a civil engineer, involved in the peaceful development of technology. But he had been beguiled by the prospect of becoming a war hero, like the commander, and of developing new war strategies and devices. In the years between lives, he was involved closely in helping others in his soul group with the proper use of technology, when he slowly began to receive a vision of another life approaching. Slowly at first, and then with great conviction, he realized that soon mass energy devices would be discovered that had the potential of liberating mankind, but these devices would be extremely dangerous. As he felt himself being born, he knew that he would come to work for the proper use of this technology, and he was well aware that in order to succeed, he would have to again face his tendency to crave power and recognition and status. Yet he saw that he would have help. There would be six other people. He visualized the valley working together somewhere in the dark, the falls in the background, utilizing a process to bring in the world vision. As he began to fade from view, I could barely make out parts of the process. First, the group of seven would begin to remember past experiences and work through the residual feelings. Then, the group would consciously amplify their energy, using the eighth insight techniques, and each would express their particular birth vision. And finally, the vibration would accelerate, unifying the soul groups of the seven individuals. And out of the knowledge gained would come the full memory of the intention behind human history. And then, at last, the detailed picture would arrive of our intended future, the world vision, the view of where we're going and what we have to do to reach our destiny. Suddenly, the whole scene disappeared, along with Feynman's group. Will and I were left there alone. Will's eyes were animated. "Do you see what's happening?" he asked. "This means that Feynman's original intention was actually to perfect and decentralize the technology he's working on. If he realizes this fact, he will stop the experiment." "We've got to find him," I said. "No," Will replied, pausing to think. "That won't help. Not yet. We've got to find the rest of this group of seven. It must take the pooled energy of a group to bring in the memory of the world vision, a group that can work through the process of remembering and energize themselves." "I don't understand this part about clearing residual feelings." Will moved closer. "Remember the other mental images you've been having? The memories of other places, other times?"
"Yes."
"The group that is forming to deal with this experiment has been together before. There will be residual feelings that must be worked through. Everyone will have to deal with them." Will looked away for a moment, then said,
This is more of the tenth insight. Not just one group is coming in. There are many others. We'll all have to learn to clear these resentments. As he spoke, I thought about the group situations I'd experienced. Some members of the group liked each other immediately, while others seemed to fall into instant discord for no apparent reason. I wondered, was human culture now ready to perceive the distant source of these unconscious reactions? Then, without warning, another shrill sound reverberated through my body. Will grabbed me and pulled me closer, our faces almost touching. If you fall again, I don't know if you can get back while the experiment is operating at this level, he shouted. You'll have to find the others. Second blast ripped us apart, and I felt myself released into the familiar swirling colors, knowing that I was heading back, as before, into the Earth dimension. Yet, this time, instead of tumbling quickly into the physical, I seemed to linger momentarily. Something was pulling at my solar plexus, moving me laterally. As I strained to focus, the surging environment calmed, and I began to sense the presence of another person, without actually seeing the individual's form. I could almost remember the character of the feeling. Who makes me feel this way? At last, I began to discern a blurry figure 30 or 40 feet away, which moved closer, gradually, until I recognized who it was. Charlene. As she closed to within 10 feet, I sensed the shift in my body as though I was suddenly relaxing more completely. Simultaneously, I noticed a pinkish-red energy field that encircled Charlene. Seconds later, to my amazement, I noticed an identical field around myself. When we were about 5 feet from each other, the relaxation in my body grew into an increased sensuousness, and finally into a wave of orgasmic love. I suddenly couldn't think. What was happening? Just as our fields were about to touch, a shrill dissonance returned, and I was jolted backwards again, twisting out of control. As my head cleared, I gradually became aware of something cold and wet against my right cheek. Slowly I opened my eyes, the rest of my body frozen in place. For a moment, the half-grown wolf looked at me and sniffed hard, his tail bristling, then dashed into the woods as I jerked back and sat up. In a tired stupor, I retrieved my pack in the fading light and walked into the thick trees and raised my tent, afterward virtually collapsing into the sleeping bag. For a moment I struggled to stay awake, intrigued by my strange meeting with Charlene. Why had she been in the other dimension? What had drawn us together? The next morning I awoke early and made oatmeal, wolfing it down, and then made my way carefully back to the small creek I'd passed on my way up the ridge to wash my face and fill my canteen. I still felt tired, but I was also anxious to find Curtis. Suddenly, I was jolted to my feet by the sound of an explosion toward the east. That had to be Curtis, I thought, as I ran to the tent. A wave of fear passed through me as I quickly packed and headed toward the sound of the blast. After about half a mile, the woods ended abruptly at what appeared to be an abandoned pasture. Several strands of rusty barbed wire hung loosely between the trees in my path. I surveyed the open field and the line of trees and dense brush 100 yards beyond. At that moment, the bushes parted, and Curtis burst through and headed in a dead run straight toward me. I waved, and he slowed to a fast walk. When he reached me, he carefully climbed through the barbed wire and collapsed against a tree, breathing rapidly. What happened? I asked. What did you blow up? He shook his head. I couldn't do much. They're running the experiment underground. I didn't have enough explosives, and I didn't want to hurt the people inside. All I could do was blow up an outside dish antenna, which hopefully will delay them. He paused for a moment as we heard the sound of trucks in the distance. We'll have to get out of this valley, he continued, and find some help. We don't have any choice now. They'll be coming. Wait a minute, I said. I think we have a chance to stop them, but we've got to find Maya and Charlene. His eyes widened. Are you talking about Charlene Billings? That's right. I know her. She used to do some contract research for the corporation. I haven't seen her for years, but I saw her last night, going into the underground bunker. She was walking with several men, all of them, heavily armed. Were they holding her against her will? I couldn't tell, Curtis said distractedly, his ears tuned to the trucks, which now seemed to be heading in our direction. We've got to get out of here. I know a place where we can hide until dark, but we'll have to hurry. He looked back toward the east. I set a false trail, but it won't sidetrack him for long. I've got to tell you what happened, I said. I found Will again.
Right, right. Tell me on the way, he said, walking quickly. We've got to move.